Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with up-and-coming Chicago-based jazz pianist and writer Julian Davis Reed. We get into his new and stellar 2026 album, Vocation, and his life in the world of jazz. He is known for his work with the Juju Exchange and Isaiah Collier, amongst others, and is steadily building a name of his own. This new album is an immersive exploration of sound and story rooted in jazz that reaches into gospel. Vocation showcases the depth and versatility of his ensemble, with each musician's voice contributing vitally to the album's lush narrative arc. At heart, he is an artist and theologian whose work invites us to rejoice, lament, and hope together. He has toured in Asia, Europe, and across North America, and the journey just continues to grow. Enjoy this conversation. Well, let's get into the new album. Before we do that, I want to know this. You know, we don't talk about it a lot, but it was such a big deal. 6 years ago, this pandemic changed the landscape of so many things, especially for musicians. How did you get through that era, and how has it changed the way that you create and deliver music today?
Thank you for asking that.
Yeah.
6 years ago, I was in angst about what my career would look like because it had beached so many of us in terms of our careers. And so I use that time to sit, to get quiet, to listen to God, to listen to my community. And what people started to say was that my music was really restful, which I found intriguing. So one of the things that emerged out of the pandemic was this record right here, a solo piano record called Rest Assured, that happened in 2021. And that would launch my sense of solo artistry. My band at the time, the Juju Exchange, was creating. And then I started creating my own solo stuff, and that would eventually lead to Vocation, which came out last year. But the pandemic was a time of real listening and getting in touch with contemplative spirituality for me, and that led to a lot of creating. Notes of Rest is a project I have around Black music and contemplative spirituality, and then also my solo music, and that would lead to the birth of my solo career.
So Vocation, it's a wonderful album. What was kind of your overarching vision, and how does it feel to have this out into the world and the way that you wanted it to be?
Man, Vocation has been a dream come true. It's a project. It's really my coming of age story as an artist. It's about my calling as an artist and how it means for me to be an artist in the world. And as an artist, tell the stories of all the other callings I have on my life. And so through Vocation, I'm telling the story of being called as a husband and as a father, as a Black man, as a citizen of the world, and as a brother, and all these different titles, all these different calls in my life. And my hope is that the record helps people on stage who play with me and people who hear it on the radio, who hear it in their homes, who hear it at a show, to hear the callings on their lives. Your calling as a spouse, as a partner, as a sibling, as a child, as a lover, as a creature of this world, a creature of God. And it's just been great to be able to play and to see people's expressions, Joe. Man, that's been like nothing else. So really thankful.
So what are you hoping the listener gets from this album?
My hope is that you get to hear a story, a call on your life that you have, and that you get to hear all these different sounds come together in ways that invite you to play your calling, to play your story. I tell stories all the time at the shows, and the stories on the record are baked into the titles. So for instance, Nerve to Be Super is for my friend Michael. And Nerve to Be Super is about my friend who suffered with nerve damage, and he loves superheroes. And so I would play this music, and I played it for him, and it was about his story, but it was also about everybody who had a Michael in their life. So at the shows, I dedicated to everybody who has a Michael. My friend Michael passed a couple years ago. But I dedicate it to everybody who has a Michael in your life. And maybe you're a Michael who deals with chronic pain. And so that song has a story that's at its origin tucked into it. And my hope is that every song on that record inspires the listener to hear their story.
So you're originally from Chicago?
Yep.
Right on. So take me back to your roots. How did music become this career? And was it always going to be music?
No, actually, that's what makes it feel so free and so joyful and so honest. Music for me has always been a love, a deep love. But I was always in the church. I was always in my books. And so I thought that I was going to have a more conventional career. I went to Yale and studied philosophy, thought I was going to do finance, like a lot of people who go that route. And yet the music kept calling. And so for me, growing up, Chicago was such an honest, earnest place to experience blues and jazz and gospel. The classical scene, black classical music, has a lot of roots here in Chicago too. Florence Price, Lena McLin. I was on the jazz scene, taking lessons with Willie Pickens and going to jam sessions at the Showcase and everywhere else. The Velvet Lounge back in the day, Von Freeman's joint. I mean, so there's all kinds of formations happening. And then that would follow me into adulthood, where a lot of people I was making music with in high school, I would make music with as adults. And that would be in the Juju Exchange, my jazz fusion project. But then also my career in music would grow as a result of getting back into the city and getting connected to people who I met once I moved back from my time elsewhere. I went to undergrad at Yale. I went to grad school in Atlanta. And so after 11 years gone, coming back to Chicago, man, what an incubator. And that's the sound you hear on Vocation. Tremaine Parker, Micah Collier, James Russell Sims, and a whole host of other characters, including Leonard Simpson, the sax player. It's been so dope being able to create from both my old life growing up in Chicago on the South Side, but then also my new life living here on the West Side with my wife and now daughter.
So what was the first live show you saw, jazz or otherwise, that made you think, I want to do that one day, or it just moved you?
The first immediate thought I have is going back to Velvet Lounge jam sessions. So here on the South Side of Chicago, near South Side, all the time growing up in high school, I would go to these jams, and I just remember seeing cats like Marquise Hill, who's from here, or yeah, Isaiah Spencer, and seeing all these cats playing and soaring and experimenting, and I just really felt that love. But I remember creating music with my friends in the Juju Exchange when I got older, and I was thinking then, wow, this actually could be a viable career. Fast forward a couple of years, I then started working with Isaiah Collier. I was in his band for a couple of years, the saxophonist, and those shows were so intense, so powerful, so alive. It was during those years that I really started to think about what would it mean to create my own sound that felt in this way, this alive. So between all these different places, all these different pit stops, I really was experiencing incredible sound. One show that was, I was already in on the idea of playing music as a career, but one place that really cemented that was when I got to see Roscoe Mitchell with Vincent Davis and Junius Paul. I saw them at the Promontory before it closed, a spot here in town a couple years ago. And I just remember how riveted I was during that show, just how moved I was during that show. And so between that and then seeing Herbie Hancock, also a piano native from Chicago, the first time I saw him, I remember, I'll tell you this, Joe, many people don't know this. When I first saw him, it was in Atlanta while I was in grad school. And I see him at the Symphony Center there. And the place is packed, of course. And we're in the last rows. It's on my birthday. And a standing ovation at the end. And as people clap for him, including me, at some point I turn around and I imagine myself being on stage and I bow.
Yeah. So, you know, when you decided that you were going to be a musician, you have all these ideas of what your career is going to be like, waking up every day, making music and giving it to the people. And then you live the life. What's been the difference between this ideological version of what you thought it was going to be and living and being in the soup?
Oh, man, the persistence that you need to play, the way the career is not linear. You know, you have a good tour, you have some good time interviews, you get on some shows going, some records happen, Instagram looks nice and curated, and then things mellow out and you got to go back to the drawing board and you listen back to yourself and there's something you really didn't like about that solo. In my mind, all the pictures of all the greats, they're happy all the time, they're making it work. There's other, you know, then you read the biographies, you read the autobiographies, and you see Miles put down his horn for 5 years. I mean, all of this has helped me see that it's not a linear process, but that it's one that always requires you to protect your creativity. And that has been something that's kept me moving and thinking not only about the art. The other thing is you got to think about the business, and that tons of people make music all day and they don't have any sense of the business and they leave. You know, it just becomes too much. The cats who stay are ones who have some sense of the business. I remember Roy Hargrove saying in his documentary on tour, it was towards the end of his life, he said, they pay us to travel. The playing is free.
What was that thing where if you want to make money, you go in with 200 and then if you make 100, you have 100. You got to go in with the money. I've heard that before.
Man, that's real. And it's, yeah. You know, it's not getting any easier with AI. Stagflation's real for musicians. We haven't in many cases gotten real raises in clubs for a while. And so these are real challenges. And I'm not faulting the clubs per se. I mean, margins are tight for everybody. I mean, the economy's going up and down. Iran, all this stuff impacts how we are able to show up and how listeners are able to show up. So I don't complain. I don't bemoan. I've chosen this. But it is helpful to be aware, and it's so helpful to learn more and more about the history, to read Miles and Herbie, and they'll talk about their business, and they'll talk about their challenges, and you just get a sense that nothing's new under the sun. And so what those cats went through, often in the unglamorous stuff offstage, is similar to what you go through. And those cats were at the top of the top. I mean, kind of exceptions, and yet still speaking to realities that any musician is going to go through.
It's interesting you bring up kind of the economics and the Iran thing and what's going on in America. We are in a very strenuous, stressful time. And yes. I think music and giving people music, whether it's recorded or live, is essential to our mental health. How much of that goes through what you're thinking right now, that you're helping people have an oasis from all of this clownery that we're getting bombarded with all the time?
Beautiful. Clownery, bombarded, yes. All those words are key. And what I offer is a space to transmute that pain. I wrote in an essay on Black music and faith. I wrote in an essay about how, and it's in this book called Naming the Spirit. In that book, I write this essay about how my hope is Black music can be a space where oppression and corruption can be transmuted into healing. And I believe in that and try to live that for my bones. I wear orange all the time. There's orange on my shirt now. I will always wear orange on stage because orange is the international color of hope. And my hope is that people come to listen to music and they can bring all the pain, because I firmly believe music does one of two things. Music either tells you how you feel right now and tells you that you're seen, and or music gives you something to aspire to. I see those, it's one of those two, almost if not all the time. And I'm thankful that my concerts, that my shows, that my records, that my interviews, that my social media presence can be a space to give people these offerings, especially in times like these. But I know Nina Simone, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis getting beaten by the cops, Bud Powell getting beaten by the cops, Louis Armstrong playing segregated clubs, none of this is new. And the legacy of Black music that I steward is one in which I'm paying attention to what it means for me to have my turn now.
So what gets you up every day? What do you look forward to as a professional musician? Why do you love to live your life this way?
Oh, the last line in The Prestige, one of my favorite movies, and Hugh Jackman's character, he's dying. Christian Bale has won. Christian Bale has shot him, but as Hugh Jackman is dying, he really gets the last word, because he tells Christian Bale, I did this career as a magician. They were magicians in Britain. I did this career because of the look on their faces. It was the look on their faces. And I always hold to that. I did my title track song or single off the record called Moan. And I played that the other day, duo with the singer Tremaine. And there was audible weeping in the room. I mean, people were sobbing because the moan had opened up space for them. It's the look on their faces. And I hold to that when it's hard, when it doesn't look like it's a linear up and to the right, when things are complicated and confusing, when you hear no or you hear nothing at all. I remember that. It's the look on their faces. Yeah, man.
I love it. What a great line, man. You know, the one thing I think about, I've been in Kansas City my whole life. Tried to get out a couple times. I tried to get to Chicago at one point. I was going to try to get into DePaul and do another thing, but what I'm saying is that I've seen this town transform over my life. And sometimes I sit in a club and I've been covering this scene for 15 years and I'm like, yeah. Like, we can't get pigeonholed with Bird. We can't get pigeonholed with certain figureheads, Count Basie and all of that. This is happening. This is a fluid thing. Music and jazz is a fluid thing. And I think about you staying in Chicago. Do you sometimes get yourself either sitting in the crowd or sitting on the stage thinking, yeah, I stayed here. I'm watching. I'm a part of this evolutionary timeline of the music scene in this town.
Absolutely. I love the way you put it. It reminds me of how a pastor once said, you can be a river or you can be a swamp. And it's helpful to think about what it means to be a river and how rivers have water that's constantly flowing, whereas swamps, on purpose, have water that sits and collects. Both are ecosystems, but I like to be a river. And I see Chicago, and you were just using that language of flow and movement. I see that in Chicago. I see that in all these scenes. You know, it used to be that there were labels here. You could still see Chess Records near downtown, and that was huge for Chicago. But a lot of record labels left decades ago, and a lot of cats who have stayed. I mean, you have International Music Anthem. You have other record labels here in town. But a lot of what happens in Chicago, it comes from people who are being independent, who are making things happen through grassroots connection. And it, like you said, it's been powerful to see this evolution that weaves together hip hop and jazz and blues. And again, I was talking about classical. All this is happening here. And I've been thankful to have my family here, to have music here, to have the support, and be a part of an ecosystem that is seeking to be a river.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned a couple seminal live moments to be in Vaughn's Club. Like, the Vaughn Freeman is the history of jazz in Chicago. When you think about that, his name comes up. But then Herbie Live. But if you had your druthers and you can get into a time machine and go back in time and see one show, you could even see a few. Where are you going? Who are you going to see?
I'm definitely seeing Miles Davis's second quintet with a young Herbie,
Yep.
Tony. I mean, the record I've been stewing in, that's my sound. When I go to pray, often I hear Tony Williams's ride. I'm constantly listening to young Herbie, getting his sense of playing out, playing in, playing one hand. Ron Carter oftentimes directing the band. There's a record of them because Miles was from the Chicago, Illinois. He would oftentimes do the Christmas dates here in town at the Plug Nickel, a club that's no longer. And there's a record now that's out, a live taping from that called Live at Plug Nickel. And man, that I wish I could have been there. Also, I learned Ron Carter during those dates was expecting a child back in New York. And so what I heard was he would play those gigs at night and then in the morning take the 6 a.m. or whatever to New York, see if anything happened, and then in that afternoon get on a flight and come back to Chicago to play that next night. I just can't even fathom. So I mean, that stretch of shows must have been so catalytic, and you can hear it on the record. It was just so catalytic, so experimental. And that second quintet really is a sound that for me is a thin place between heaven and earth.
For sure. You know, one of the beauties of the jazz art form is that the elders, the legends, the luminaries always do their best to keep this torch alive. They pass their wisdom, they pass their skills and knowledge down. What have you learned from the veterans and legends and luminaries that they've given to you that you in turn give to younger players that you get around?
One is to keep it light. I didn't even talk to Herbie about this, but I got to see him backstage once, and I was watching him play a set in San Jose. I had played a little earlier, and he was 84, 85 at the time. And his keytar wasn't working. And I remember him turning to the sound man, and he just had the biggest smile and was like, hey man, this isn't working. Herbie Hancock, the cat who invented basically this thing, who's been playing it for decades, a pioneer, and it's not working on his gig at this stage in his life. He could have been pissed. He could have been all number of things. But he taught me a lot without saying a word. Now, I would talk to him elsewhere in that set. But that was really important. Another thing is Terrence Blanchard told me, we talked about it now several times. He said that Milt Hinton told him, you don't have to practice. I tell my students, they don't have to practice. And the students will be like, what? He's like, oh, yeah, you don't have to practice, but don't get mad when you meet somebody who does. That's one. And then the last thing I'll say is Vincent Davis, who's a deep mentor of mine here in Chicago, AACM. He's a drummer. Like I said, he played that show with Roscoe Mitchell. And I take lessons with him in his concept around free jazz and at his crib. And he says to me all the time that you have to remember that there are many laps around this track. And that has helped steady me when I've gotten a little off kilter or things are moving this way or that. And he's like, I've seen a lot, man. And I've seen a lot on this track. And you stay with focus. You pay attention when you have forks in the road. And I try to give that to other musicians, cats who are coming along, cats who are being resourceful, cats who get discouraged. All of that is helpful. And then, of course, I learned from the autobiographies. Richard Johnson, who used to play jazz in Lincoln Center with Wynton Marsalis, he plays piano. He told me, go read the biographies. Yep. Those cats will tell you everything. Clark Terry, Herbie, Wayne, Miles, these cats, they write it and then they die.
Yeah.
And he's been right as rain, you know, to read these biographies, to soak in the knowledge of things that I don't get to talk about with the greats in person. That's been fantastic.
So let's get to the marrow in your bones. Everyone has a perception of you, family, friends, fans, colleagues, the business side, but you run the show. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Ooh, Joe. Yes, man.
We went right there.
Yes, this is it. I'm loved. I'm loved. And I am taking chances as one who's loved. I'm assured in that, and I'm exploring and growing, and I am patient. People often say, oh, Julian, you're booked, you're doing this, you're doing that, I see you all over. And I'm not interested ultimately in that. I'm interested in how I feel. And what I try to feel is loved, loved by myself, loved by God, loved by my wife, my daughter. And also, I try to hold to an abundance that's not ultimately about achievement, because achievements come and go. I remember Devin Daniels play sax. I saw him play with Herbie, Terrence, and the like on a gig. And then I saw him playing with a cat who's coming up, you know, a young and up-and-coming singer. Cool, for sure, dope. But not Herbie's legendary status. And he played just as hard there as he did with Herbie. And I remember thinking, man, this cat is really thinking ultimately about the music writ large, not about what he's achieved. Because if it was really about that, playing with Herbie and then playing with anybody who wasn't a legend, that would mess with your head.
Yeah.
I try to hold to that. I'm loved and I'm trying to play with an abundance that's not ultimately indexed to my achievements.
Beautiful. So Vocations, the wonderful new album. If anybody wants to get a copy, it's streaming everywhere. But if anybody wants to download, buy a copy, catch you live, where do they go?
JulianDavisReed.com.
All right. Julian, man, I tell you, Herbie, like, all I've ever heard is that dude's a saint. Like, he is a saint incarnate on this planet. So are a lot of those legendary cats. They just hum at a different thing. And thank, good for us, man, because we need that energy on this planet. Yes, more than do. Ever.
You're right, man. It's been a gift. Been
man.
A gift.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, it was great to meet you.
You got it. Thank you so much for this, Joe.
Thanks for listening and tuning into another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Chicago, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Julian for his time and story. If you want to hear more Neon Jazz interviews, you can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us at YouTube, and for everything Neon Jazz, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.